What a wonderful nation of people we are, really. We have topples all around us. You know, for a moment when Fedder was speaking in his charming manner, and to know that a boy who's brilliant in his academic life and can be so humorous, this is a wonderful mixture of peoples. And you forget the clouds for a moment. But I must say this, and when he spoke about giving up, suggesting the boys to give up part of their diet, for he went as far as a month, I must say it sent a shiver down me, as it did you, but a shiver of humility and also at the same time a feeding of pride that these boys show their solidarity to the state of Israel in the plight that we're in. May I, Fedo, on behalf of the governors and behalf of Israel and other people, thank you for that wonderful gesture, which I am sure will remain in your minds till victory passes. Because, in particular, as you suggested, if you play the game on and off the field, this will indeed be that right will be just. And if only the politicians of the world were to play the game and not use funny words, be direct, as you were, be truthful, let us know where they stand, I'm sure the world at large will certainly be better off. Now, Speech Day, of course, is greatly enchanted normally by the selection of our guest of honour. We are indeed most grateful, we are indeed very fortunate in having as our guest of honour here today a charming gentleman, Professor Sir Alexander Oppenheim. Sir Alexander is a Mancunian, and they always tell you that what Manchester thinks today, we think tomorrow. Felix says we thought yesterday, but Sir Alex is a person of great academic distinction and wide administrative experience. He was for several years Vice Chancellor of the Malaya University, spent a long time in Singapore. He is now at Reading University. Many universities have expressed their recognition of his valuable contribution in the field of mathematics and learning by conferring upon him numerous degrees. Many a boy with academic aspirations would no doubt like to emulate him. I know I would. We are indeed grateful to you, Sir Alex, for giving us the privilege of having you here with us this afternoon. And may I express personally the pleasure that I personally had in this easy discussions during our repast at lunchtime. I don't think we had a better lunch than you boys did. It was a jolly good lunch. But I must say, you, Sir Alex, made everybody feel very much at ease. And I'm sure it's this, the greatest of our men, right through the ages, have been our men who've shown humility with our greatness. And it was my privilege today to extend to you, Sir Alexander Oppenheimer.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Headmaster, Mrs. Halevy, Mr. Chairman of the Whittingham Old Boys Association, it's important not to make a mistake at this stage. I want to thank you all for according me this privilege of being here today. But before I begin to talk about the themes which have already been discussed amply and so eloquently today, I ought to correct 2 points. First, my name isn't Oppenheimer. It is Oppenheim. You'll all recall that there is, or was rather, a writer of thrillers, E. Phillips Oppenheim, and a very great Jew, John Robert Oppenheimer, whose death recently we all deplore, who gave a series of lectures, the Wreath Lectures in Britain, recently. And Punch wrote the following lines to distinguish between them. Fiction may be sublime, but fact is far sublimer. For fiction is but Oppenheim, while fact is Oppenheimer. My own name has suffered other transformations from time to time. For example, I was, for a period, a lecturer in mathematics at Edinburgh University, and my landlady could not get her tongue round the syllables of that name, which to you and to me seems to be so simple. She insisted on calling me Dr. Opium. That may, of course, account for my subsequent career. It may, of course, account for the fact that I have been the leader of worldwide conspiracies for drug running and heaven knows what. But from time to time, when mistakes occur with my name, I go back humbly to that experience in Edinburgh. I said it was a privilege to be here today, but the privilege has come my way through two accidents. The first, and the more important one, is this, that distinguished Nobel laureate, that illustrious scientist, whose name I need not mention here, on your board of governors, had other duties calling him away. He it was who should have addressed you today, and I am only a pale shadow of what he can be and what he is. And secondly, there is this point. I was called to the telephone from my office in Reading, and a voice from the past greeted me, a voice I had not heard for 22 years. Such is the commanding personality of your headmaster, such is his skill, that even his voice over the telephone, asking me was I free on Sunday, June the 4th, evoked from me immediately, without hesitation, without any afterthought, the monosyllable yes. And before I knew where I was, I found I had accepted the honor of being your guest here today and of speaking at this prize giving. As I sat here this afternoon, listening to the magnificent speakers, and listening in particular, and I know my friends here, Mr. Chairman in particular, will not disagree with me when I say this, listening in particular to the headmaster and his eloquence so rightly displayed, I felt that there was no need for me to be here at all today. Because it seems to me, in this school, we have just what makes a school. I meant to quote to you two Chinese proverbs. I will quote them, because there is something astonishingly familiar in these Chinese proverbs to people who have been brought up in the Jewish way. This may be due to the fact that for centuries there were Jews, still are a few Jews, in China. The two proverbs I want to quote are these. May heaven and earth devour the student who does not respect his teacher. Thunder and lightning destroy the teacher who neglects his student. I know they sound warlike, I know they sound ruthless, but let us go a little into the meaning of these things. Respect for the teacher. Of course, but the teacher must be worthy of it. The teacher must show, by his way of life, by his conduct, by his attitude to learning, what he understands by these things. It's for this that the student will respect the teacher. And the teacher who neglects his students, the kind of man who treats a student merely as a vessel, a receptacle into which knowledge is poured, a vessel from which ultimately he'll be able to drain off a few rather bad answers to questions badly set at certain times of the year. Not such here are the teachers or the students of Whittingham College. I knew this before I came, but what I've heard this afternoon has reinforced my conviction that here we do have a really fine school. It is 22 years since I last met Jacob Halevi. I met him just after the war in this small school in Brighton. You've moved here today, in wonderful surroundings. There couldn't be better. Buildings, labs, new buildings to come. And they don't matter one jot. I congratulate you on them. You're lucky to have them. But they don't matter two pins. What does matter? The students and the men and women who teach them. Those men and women who can show them what life means, who can show them what the learning of the past has to offer, and what the learning of the future will give, what the new ideas will give. To teachers, that we're all part of a common humanity, because if that lesson is lost, we are all lost. This, I think, is fundamental. You will ask why I stress this business of a common humanity. I can give my reasons quite simply. In 1942 and up to September 1945, I was a prisoner of war in the Far East. I saw my comrades die. I saw them die by the thousands, by the tens of thousands. We have to use today such words as, this is a commonplace, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, we say, because so many people have suffered. But this suffering must count for something. We cannot afford to let this kind of event occur again and again in the world's history. We must put an end to it. The world today is small. I want to stress that word. It's a question of definition. And any physicist will tell you that small and large are relative terms. There was a man who went into a drugstore in the United States to buy some toothpaste. And he asked for a small tube. The chemist handed him a tube on which was written the word large. But I wanted a small tube, he said. This toothpaste comes in three sizes: large, colossal, super colossal. The large size is the small size. I have mentioned this deliberately. Advertisers use language of that kind to make you think you're getting a bargain. But I use the word small about the world deliberately. It is a small world today. It's only 150 years ago since it would take you a week to go from London to Edinburgh. Today, in a week, you can go around the world. In a few minutes only, an intercontinental ballistic missile can go from Moscow to Washington, or Washington to Moscow. Have not our politicians learnt their lesson yet? We talk about United Nations. I think the parable of the boat and the passengers is worthwhile repeating. Remember the story? One man began to bore a hole under his seat, and the other people expostulated. But he said, it's my seat, I have every right to bore a hole there. No, they said, if you bore this hole, we will all drown. We are, each of us, accountable to all others. And this applies whether we are Jews or Christians or Muslims. We're all inhabitants of the world. The world is the ship. The passengers are the nations, or if you like, their leaders. And what do we see today? But the greatest of the powers busily boring holes. For what purpose? Presumably to bring an end to the world. The story goes that elsewhere than in this solar system, there was a planet with a league of disunited nations. And these nations had one principle, that each nation shall have an army to match the armies of all the other nations put together. Some of you, mathematically minded, will see that there are three possible solutions to this problem. Each nation spends all it has on making armaments and building up forces. Ultimate bankruptcy is certain. There are two other solutions. No nation requires any armaments. And finally, there's one solution: world government. The planet of which I spoke has ceased to exist. You know what solution they chose. They chose the solution of going all out for war, of going all out for armaments of every kind, dissipating the energies which could have been used to build a fairer world for all concerned. But there comes a time when actions must be taken. It was only after much thought in the 30s that I decided I must become a soldier. I hated war. I still hate war as much as any man. But it seemed to me the choice had to be made. No alternative, I believe, was a general commanding. That turn will come again. I regret it, but it has to be. It need not be, but it may have to be. We do not want the nations of the world to dig their own grave in what is happening now in the Middle East. We want them to realize that there is enough in this world, enough in the resources that men have accumulated over the ages, enough in the wisdom garnered from every quarter of the globe, from every century, and from people of every race. There is enough in this world to provide happiness for all. This, it seems to me, is the message of this school, of one school among many. And yet it is a message which has been given preeminently in this school. I was told I should speak for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. As usual, I get carried away because I fail to follow the notes I wrote out so laboriously. Let that pass. I meant to say a few words about education. I was delighted to hear that the able head boy of this school came at the age of 7. And I wondered, as I heard that, what had happened in the first 7 years of his life. What sort of education had he received? And I recall the story of the Jewish mother who went to the rabbi to ask him what she should do about the education of her boy. How old is he? He will be 5 tomorrow. Rung back quickly, mother. You are 5 years late. Education begins in the home. It begins in the family. We are fortunate, it seems to me, among jury, that family life is so important, so intensely important, that every Jewish parent strives to do the utmost he can for his children. I said he, but of course he includes the she. The mother is equally concerned. This, I think, is perhaps the most important trait of Jewish life. I compile it among other people's too, but it is a fundamental point and one which must be stressed. And now I must come to the end of my few words. It's more than 40 years since I went to a Jewish school. In spite of what the chairman said, this is not the first Jewish school in Britain. It's certainly the best now. But I did go to a small elementary school in Derby Street, Manchester, the Jewish Elementary School. And plainly, I cannot forget it, nor would it be right of me to forget it. And I remember the speech days then, and at the Manchester Grammar School, and I remember fidgeting with the other boys, yes, I was a boy once, fidgeting with the other boys on the bench, wondering when the prosy old gentleman at the dais would stop jabbering away, wondering when he would cease from chattering and allow us to get on with the important things of life. There's a difference between age and youth. Old men come to the stage when they know that they know not. And young men happily know all the answers. You may remember the story of Mark Twain and his father. When Mark Twain was 14, he was astonished at his father's ignorance. 7 years later, when Mark Twain was 21, he was astounded to realize how much his father had learned during those 7 years. So I say to my young friends, be hopeful. The time will come when even old people like myself will reach the higher levels. May I thank you, Mr. Chairman, you, Mr. Headmaster, Mr. Levy, and all here, for allowing me to come to this speech prize day giving and to listen to such wonderful speeches. If I've been able to contribute something, it is because I've learned so much from those who spoke before me.
Give me permission to...
Please.